And I see from the words that say the NetBSD project under my name, I have an interest and involvement with the NetBSD project. Jim and I just got back, and when I say I just got back a few hours ago, I haven't even been home yet, from Barcelona. And we had a 3-day conference from Friday through Sunday. And I'm going to talk soon, after Jim is done, about what the conference was, who was there, what it's all about, and also give a recap of the talk that I gave there. But first, Jim is going to explain a concept that I missed, which is package jam. I was sleeping through that one Saturday morning. But thankfully, he's here and he can talk about what it is. So, Jim?
Well, a diagram for everybody. Shouldn't hand things out, but I will anyway. Right. Anybody here use Package Source?
Yay!
Two. What's your favorite package manager? Why would anybody not use Package Source? Can somebody else tell me what you use?
Salt Field.
It doesn't run in my operating system.
I like App RPM. What's it been called? This
I like App.
I think with a lot of people, it's, I mean, for me, it's like previous ports and OVC ports. Mm-hmm. And if I have to be on a Mac, I'm on a Mac, I use MacPorts.
MacPorts.
And it's just the comfort level with using previous ports and the ports.
Right, the ports idea.
Same Jordan Hubbard concept thing for so many years. It's like,
right. So, Johnny Lynn and I were at the NetBSD con last October. He mentioned some ideas that he had, and I mentioned some ideas that I had. And that coalesced this past January and February, something like that, into a set of ideas which we named Package Jam. And the idea behind Package Jam is to bring Package Source, I would say, into the 21st century. There are three major components. The first one is that we use a different style installation tree, so that when you install things, they don't just go into user package, but rather each package goes in its own directory. Second element is that we track the availability of packages and the installation of packages and your preferences in databases, three relational databases. And the third piece is that there's a build tool, which is rather more like, I would say, the RPM style of things, where you simply say tool, instruction, package, right? So Johnny's currently calling his package PKG, package, so you say package install, bomb, right? Live XML2, and off you go. So there is a source tree that maintains a database. I'll go into these databases briefly. In fact, I'll get a copy of this to myself. Easiest way to think about this is that we already have a database of kinds, right, of sorts, called the DB database. It's just a key value system, which maintains the installed binaries that are on your system. That's what Package Source uses today. That's what Ports uses too, no? What we've done is we've said, look, that's great, except it doesn't help us with a lot of other complexity, and we're going to be adding some complexity. If we're going to put each package in its own location, then we've introduced some complexity, which we'd like to be able to track, right? In fact, packages are going to exist in many places. If you think about it, the executables, the binaries, right, they're going to be in their own directory, like everything is in its own directory. It also has to be in some place where the shell can find all the binaries, all the executables. Equally, libraries that are shared each live in their own directory, but then the library is also hard linked to the place where it's needed by an application. So you may have one inode, right, which is in the packages, if you want to think of an inode being the canonical place, one inode being in its own package directory, and that inode has links to the various places where it's referenced. You could actually reconstruct a lot of this bin database from, you know, if you took the time and you went use find and ls and stuff, you could actually figure out which things are being used by which. You would need a single file system if you're going to use links. It's not necessary to use links. You could copy stuff around. You could even do this in a file system that didn't support links. I understand there's some of them. That install shield one, I think, is one. But well, they're so much better.
Tom shows his two bells.
MySQL on Route 34.
Right. So you can, you have benefits from using hard links in the sense that you don't duplicate the space, and you have, you know, you maintain this relationship. But there's nothing that requires it, because the database is really keeping track of this stuff for you. Then you've got, on the local side, today you've got a variety of ways. There's mk.conf that we use in Packet Source. There's a variety of ways you can specify preferences that you have and ways that you can extend the system in some way or another. We decided that really the best way to do that is to maintain a database of site preferences. These site preferences are become an integral part of the database when you build the package and when you are consulting the system for what needs to be built. You can, for example, indicate that some piece of the system, for example, with the Mac, Perl, I think, comes built in on OS X, right? So you could say, that Perl is the one I want to you to use. Don't bother installing a whole new copy of Perl in user package just because you think that's where it's supposed to be. I'll just refer you to the one I've already got. And you can mark such things as either being managed by PackageJam or not being managed by PackageJam. That's up to you. The real advantage of these two databases comes when we take the third one in. Now, the third one is the big one. As you can see, it's in the middle there, and it's changing. All this stuff is quite dynamic. As we push it, we find things that we need to change, and we change them. The game here is we've created a whole new tree, and in that tree, we ask each developer to create a makefile. That makefile produces rows that are loaded into this database. When users work with this stuff, they download the source database. So the source database is constructed from CVS-controlled sources. Those CVS-controlled sources at least have a makefile that generates the rows that are necessary to load into the database for that package, but may also have any other number of rows, any other number of files it wants to have. Whatever that directory, you know, source directory wants to take care of, that's what it has. So the overall build system says, okay, tree, I'm going to go to each package, I'm going to say make. I'm going to say make packages, make knobs, make descriptions, make dependencies, and I'm going to build a bunch of files, and then those files will get loaded in the database. That database is then made available for users to download. We hope you can do that in a few minutes, really. We don't think it'll take very long, because the make files are very simple. It should be. We're just producing some flat files. Shall I take people's time to talk about the database, or would you prefer I not to? How interested are you in this?
Is there ordering involved? Build this package before that package?
Yes. That's what the dependency table does for you. So you can issue a query. Imagine a query that says, you know, look in the bin packages and find out what I've got. Look in the source packages and see what dependencies it has. Figure out which of those things I don't have yet. Right? Start building. You should be able to generate a tree from the start.
A tree of dependencies to say, I need to build X, Y, and Z. Is there a way of saying I want to actually build Z, Y, and X? Or is it a random order between the dependency tree?
If that becomes necessary, I'm happy to add it. And so far as we know, we don't have an example where that's necessary. In fact, I'd like it to be the case as much as possible that each thing builds in parallel. Right? If you've got A depending on B, C, and D, there's really normally, frequently, no reason. If each of those has no dependencies, you can build the leaves all at one time.
To some extent, we have that in Packet Source today. I have a question.
Yes.
So, coming from a position of being familiar with the user package, where all the install packages are as it is today,
yep.
And user package source, which is the thing that I have to see CVS update when I want to find out
right.
What developers have been up to, and then like the SEMK.com.
Right.
How do those concepts compare with this diagram, and what are the advantages of the system compared with what I'm missing?
As a user, you've got, I think, less complexity to manage. As a user, you download one file, perhaps a set of files, but one file for sure, the source database, that is supposed to describe what's available from PackageJam. So there's no CVS update, no coordination. You can do that if you want to. If you want to build your own source database, of course, it's open, you know, system, right? but you know, if what you do normally is fetch the quarterly release, you fetch one file. That file is standalone. It describes completely what's in the PackageGen database. It also coordinates, it can be linked to the bin database and the options database, the site database. So if I want to build something new, if I want to know what I have to build, first of all, there'll be tools to make this, you know, to do this reporting, right? But if you have some query that we haven't thought of yet, and you know how to write SQL, you can join these three things together. I think one of the major features is that today, if you want to know what options a package supports, or God forbid, what packages are affected by an option, if you want to know what in the source tree is depends, say, on live XML2, you could wait overnight to get some of those answers. Yeah. These answers come out like that. Right? In my slides, there's a query that joins three tables together and shows you a list of what things depend on live XML2. If you want to know what options, you just say, what options are affected by this package?
And that's something that just falls out of the building the PackageGen database process.
That's right.
That's right.
It's right there in your database. So I imagine a package info program that's a little more powerful, a little easier to use, but certainly one that's easier to write. Because most of the work is being done by SQLite. I'd like to say three words about SQLite. Well, maybe more than three. So what do we use for a database technology, right? We're lucky, right? We live in 2007. In 1987, SQLite didn't exist. And so SQLite is an embedded database. It's very, very small. The command line tool that you use to issue your queries, if you know about ISQL or something like that, it's two-thirds the size of LS. I have been using it for this project since its inception some months ago, and I haven't found any defects in it that matter. It doesn't enforce foreign keys. I don't care. It doesn't enforce, it doesn't have good parallelization if three processes are trying to lock the database at the same time. You lock the whole database. There's no row locking or anything like that. It doesn't matter. Authentication is a function of your file system. There's no login to the database. Those kinds of things are fine for what we're doing.
So what is this written in?
What's
the logic, the language that's using the database?
The build tool that uses the database looks like it's going to be written in Perl. People say Perl, so why Perl? I mean, why don't we use something that's portable, except Perl is portable. And it turns out that it's proof, right? It's on pretty much everything except probably data general 7.3 or something. Stealth shield, right.
There's a Perl with
Right. If when you look at the base package that you have to install, the base, what do they call that thing for installing the baseline so you can use package source?
Bootstrap.
The bootstrap itself is fairly complicated, right? Why, by the time you've got a bootstrap that can do what Perl does, you've got Perl. So we think that'll be fine, and nobody's going to care, right? The people who care actually are people who live in that space. If you don't want to work with a Perl system, then if you don't want to build Perl things, then okay. But for the most part, you're just going to run a system, right? And you've got a Perl dependency. If that's an issue, you probably should use something simpler.
Today we basically have Perl dependency. If you're a package source developer,
oh, yeah?
You need it to run package lamps, you need it to run various tools that are part of putting your packages together.
Yeah.
No change there.
When I presented this in Barcelona to the PackageSourceCon, I think Johnny was quite skeptical. He thought that people would push back and say, they don't want this, they don't want that, they don't like. The reaction was exactly the opposite. People were delighted, as far as I could tell. I didn't have any, there were some people who had some concerns, they're not sure. I said to them, look, if it doesn't do what you want, tell me what it doesn't do. And I challenge you the same way. If there's something you're doing today that this doesn't do for you, you know, tell me what it is. I'll put it in the database. Make it happen. It's new. We can make it do. But when we're finished, for sure, it's going to build all 7,000 packages that are in PackageSource today. And if you can do 7,000, you can do 70,000. The objectives here were to make it easier to run, be able to run multiple things at the same, multiple copies of the same, multiple versions, pardon me, of the same application, to be able to update your shared objects without tearing down something that uses it, to be able to attract more people to work on this project than work on PackageSource today. If it's simpler to use, if it's easier to build packages, we'll have more packagers. And I think that would be a good thing. There aren't enough packagers. Also, this database represents the accumulated knowledge about dependencies. In fact, if you don't like a build tool, you could write a different one because it's already in the database. All you got to do is extract the stuff from it and build your packages. I hope that we're going to make a contribution that, in fact, you know, would be useful to other packaging systems if they don't, even if they don't decide to go away and just use Opsy.
Is this something that you have in mind to get buy-in from PackageSource and replace certain components of PackageSource, or is it a separate system?
You know, it's a, at the moment, I don't feel like I want to jiggle those wires. I don't want to upset any apple carts. I got two metaphors in the same sentence, right? I think we need to prove what we're going to do. And then we have to ask ourselves, is it really an advantage to live inside the PackageSource tree? It might be, but it might also not be, right? PackageSource today lives in the NetBSD CVS, and NetBSD can't grant you access to the PackageSource CVS without also giving you access to the NetBSD source tree. If they fix that, then I would be very much in favor of putting that together. If without fixing that, I think the idea of bringing more people into the tree is probably not feasible.
But certainly if it works out that PackageSource fixes this work, great, as far as you're concerned.
Yes. I very much want the PackageSource people to adopt some of these ideas, even if they don't come over to this framework. And I'm really hoping that it will merge. I'm just not sure how it's going to merge. But yes, I'd absolutely like to see that happen. I don't really... PackageSource does a lot of great things in terms of release engineering and stuff like that. I can't replace all that. I think I can just make it easier to do. We're hoping to have a functioning system by the summer. We have prototypes now. The database has been partially loaded. Since I got so much positive support, I've sort of changed direction a little bit since I got back. I'm working more toward creating a workable source tree for people to join. We established a domain name. There's already a website up. That's the easy part, right? And we'll put up a project on SourceForge. We might as well do that. Use Subversion instead of CVS. Do everything modern, right? Relational databases, Subversion, and like that.
I mean, I know that PackageSource is kind of going on a little bit beyond NetBSD installs. I mean, you know, in terms of Sun and so on and so forth. I know there's been something of an impact, but and I know that one of the guys who's on our list is at a pretty major corporation that actually moved to RPM PackageSource. And a pretty big, I don't know if people saw it on the list, but it's a pretty significant firm. But, you know, in one area in video and so on like this farm. But anyway, what impact would this have on that bigger picture in terms of the cross architecture and everything else? Is it going to make it easier? Is it going to kind of like, last meeting we were talking about OpenSSH, where like, you know, OpenCVS, is it going to be like the next OpenSSH in the sense that like, oh, everybody uses it, you know, even Cisco uses it. Do you really think that this is going to actually help? I know it's a vague question, but this could actually help open that up a little bit. So get the larger popularity so it becomes really kind of OS irrelevant to people.
I hope so. How will it make it easier? It'll make it easier in the sense that there's going to be this nice platform, right, to work with. There's going to be this knowledge base, I'll call it, right, of participants.
So people can basically take PackageSource ultimately because SQLite based,
right,
in the way it's based, that they could actually, you know, just like Cisco could do what it wants and does what it wants with OpenSSH, and making its own, because of this added capability and configurability, it should actually put itself in a position where, you know, it could go a lot of different directions outside of what the straight, like, get to CBS and then go from there,
right,
approach that really is right now.
Right. I think part of the answer to your question will depend on how well we do binary packages. There were some questions about binary packages, and I'm convinced that we have those questions addressed. I'm convinced because the people who asked them like the answers that we got. That's right. The package the binary package has to have embedded in it some information that we can install into the BIM database. There's some nuances to that. But also because of the way that we're doing this, right? The way that we have these depo directories, it's really very useful to say we can build the binary database in PackageSort today. To build a binary package, you first install the package, and then you make the binary package. Well, first of all, you could do that with this system and not upset anything. And second of all, you don't have to. You could just put it in its own place and make it into a binary package without ever actually putting it into the main place where the shell would look for it, or where man would look for it, or where info would look for it. So I think we have a better system here for building binary packages, and I think that's going to be an important feature.
I mean, this is a stupid example of what I'm thinking. I'm trying to give an example of what I'm talking about. You think of some, OS or another has a stripped down version, maybe not Windows CE-ish type of thing, but like, we have this new Mac is coming out, this mini Mac portable, ultra portable thing coming out, right? Maybe this scenario is so like, someone wants to build some kind of packaging system for that.
Mm-hmm.
MacBooks is too clunky, heavy. It's not that bad, but it doesn't fit the purpose, mm-hmm. right? But Steve, you know what I'm talking about, right? Someone wants to actually build specifically like Mac ultra portable package system. They could actually, do their own system out of this and make it much easier instead of doing major overhauls and hacks, like say with previous things, of course, yeah. Right?
I think the big advantage, right, is that a lot of the complexity is pushed into tables, and beyond that, pushed to SQL. SQL is a very powerful system for organizing this kind of stuff, right? So now your build system, or your packaging, the sort of client side user system, is a lot simpler and lighter. If you think Perl is simple and light. But I actually don't think you need to use Perl. I think that that'll be the first cut. I told Johnny, I think finally the user client side of this thing, the packaging, the tool, you could probably write it in C++. Right? Because it's not going to need regular expressions. It's not going to need all the stuff Perl does, all the awk and all that stuff. You're not going to need any of that. You're just going to issue a query and go and execute bind and execute scripts.
So you could have one package that includes three other packages.
Yes.
This current schema?
One package that includes other packages, of course, because a dependency is a package. A dependency is a package.
Okay.
Right? So you have, in PackageSort today, we have the idea of a meta package. That's a package with actually no source code behind it. It's just a collection of packages.
So that's why I was saying about ordering could be important within certain dependencies. So let's say, hypothetically, I wanted to install Apache MySQL and PHP together.
Mm-hmm.
I want to install those in a certain order.
Mm-hmm.
I care that PHP comes last, for instance. So there's ordering within a single dependency that I need to convey.
You want to install PHP last. That means that last. That means that Apache is a dependency of PHP. Did I get that right?
Or is PHP a dependency? It's not even a dependency, it's ordering. I mean, either one of those can run without the other. But
mm-hmm.
if I want to install an AMP package, for
mm-hmm.
instance, mm-hmm. I want to do it, and I intend to install multiple packages simultaneously. I care that within that super package, the order within those sub packages will be installed. Mm-hmm. So I want to install MySQL, and I want to install Apache, and I want to compile PHP against MySQL. So that's what I was saying about the ordering.
Yeah, I still think if you follow the dependency graph, you get the right answer.
But it sounds like you have specific behaviors that you're expecting from the built-in behavior of PHP that you see the Apache and try and build an Apache module over it. And that's solvable by having explicit dependencies, like I want the PHP and Apache module.
That's right.
And that means that Apache needs to be there when I install PHP.
That's
just a matter of specification. Like, we have that now.
Well, I mean, PHP will do a lot of stupid stuff if you don't compile it, right? So it needs to know that something is installed prior to it.
Right, that's a row in this dependency table that says,
but
you have to put that thing there first.
What if I wanted to install just PHP alone?
Different package.
Different package.
That's true today.
Different package. Dependencies are tricky.
And by the way, compared to options, they're simple. Options were the hardest part of this. So I almost gave up. Options are difficult because they're recursive, and dependencies aren't recursive.
Well, we have problems today. If a higher level package depends on a lower level package, and they both need to have the same option, we don't even have a way to specify that now.
Right.
You just have to cross your fingers and know what you're doing.
Actually, when I was loading the database, I found some anomalies, some places where the things say they're dependent on stuff that's not there. So, that was for the building of Firefox, I think I found three like that. The daily Firefox build. We suspect that it's a thing where if it's done on Monday, once you cross the midnight boundary, and there's a date in built in the version of it.
Have you played with this and it has context with your whole tree already? Your whole force tree or not?
Yes. I have played with it in test content. I have not loaded every table from the tree at this point. I've given up trying to do that. I'm going to work instead on package for package tables. But we did as proof concept load some of the tree in order to show. We did packages, dependencies, alternatives, descriptions, categories. We did that side of the tree, that side of the database. The reason we didn't do the knobs and the options is that those things really require hacking up the maven file. They're not, you cannot interrogate the system today and get all the information from package stores. No wires will get it for you. They look at the maven files. We'd like that problem to go away. So I'm very optimistic. Johnny has been working with package source. Johnny Lance worked with package source a long time, right? He's responsible for build link 3 and a bunch of stuff before that. And gave up. As a user, he found that this was too hard to use. I could have told him that from the start. But he has a lot of knowledge about that, and I think by working together, we're going to have a very, very nice, I'm very, very optimistic about what we're going to have. Thank you for your time and attention. My daughter's waiting at home, so I'm going to go take care of her.
What's the website?
packagejam.org.
Thanks a lot.
Sure.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
There's no mail set up at that domain yet. Okay.
Thanks, Jim. I'm glad I got to hear a version of that talk, finally, back here. Cool. So that was a version of one of the talks that we had at Package Source Con. I have two more things to talk about. One is a summary of the conference, and one is, just like Jim did, a shorter version of a talk that I gave. So what order do you think I should do it in? My talk and then summary, or?
Summary.
Summary first? Okay. Conveniently, that is already loaded on this webpage, so I'm not going to have any problem with that. So that was a talk from Saturday morning. My sense of time is extremely warped right now. And I missed that, and there was another one Saturday morning. So the conference started on Friday, and it ran. We had two talks on Friday afternoon, and then four Saturday, four Sunday. That's the general shape of things. So here's my quickie talk that I did on the plane today. Package Source Con 2007 behind the makefile. Just like VH1, only not. So Jim already asked this question, so I'll raise my hand. Nobody else does, right? Too bad. Okay. This doesn't work then. neither does that. Well, I'll tell you what I use it for. I use it on Macintosh, which is the computing platform that I was essentially born with, and I use it on NetBSD, obviously.
Morama? He uses it on Hawaii, right?
I did hack my construction previous V6 too for a while. That's
okay, let's talk more about it later. But anyway, so package storage is available on a lot of platforms. We have NetBSD is obviously where it started, actually. I think I have slides about this. Let's come back to that. Who am I? Why should you listen to me? I'm a package source developer. Very proud. I'm a member of the package source project management committee, which includes Johnny Lamb, that Jim was talking about, and Thomas Klausner in Vienna, and Alistair Crooks in London. And we collectively, we're basically figureheads, because in theory our job is to resolve technical and personality conflicts as they come up. In practice, we hardly ever have to step in. And I'll come to that a little more later also. But so I'm a package source developer. I have committed once or twice to the NetBSD tree, but I try to stay away from that. That's what I'm doing. I've used NetBSD and the Macintosh pretty frequently. This web page is loaded off my server, which is NetBSD, and I have a Mac Pro sitting right next to it that is horribly underutilized. I'm a software and IT consultant in my copious free time, which I don't have because I'm a full-time college student. So, in fact, I'm never able to make it on Wednesday nights because I have problem sets that I do Thursday morning. But now it's final season, so I actually don't have anything due tomorrow. So for once, I can be here. Next semester won't be like that. I'll be back more. So what is package storage? It's a package system, which you know, and it's for managing third-party software, which on a BSD-like system, there's quite a lot of, because we're smart enough not to include all of it in the first place. Historically, it's derived from FreeBSD ports. We took, I think it was in 97 or 98, and I say we in the sense of they, because I wasn't involved at the time. We took the FreeBSD ports infrastructure and I think a few ports, and then modified it gradually into what became package source. Package source, if I recall correctly, started to become vaguely usable around NetBSD 1.2, which would have been 98, 99, which is where I got involved. One of the key differences between package source and FreeBSD ports, OpenBSD ports, is the infrastructure, which has Johnny talked about BuildLink here? Does anybody know? Okay, well, what it is, we have a whole bunch of crazy stuff going on under the hood. You still type make install like any port tree, but what's going on behind the scenes is we have a system of wrapper scripts that we stick in front of the path. And so whenever you say CC, you get our script CC. And it looks at all the arguments, it looks at all the paths, it cleans things up. And that works in concert with the BuildLink tree, which is, again, at the front of the compiler include path and linker path for the package build. And we take, when a package declares its library dependencies, we then symlink into this working directory for the package build, just the headers and libraries that the package has explicitly declared that it needs. And so in theory, except for the fact that compilers have built-in search paths that are sometimes hard to turn off on weird platforms, in theory, if a package has a dependency that it didn't declare, it will not have access to it. And the build will fail, and you realize you need to declare the dependency. So there's the wrapper scripts, there's the build link situation, and all of this works together very well to help package source work on more than just its original platform, which is NetBSD. In fact, BuildLink 2, which is a predecessor of what we have now, was partly designed by Johnny with input from me because we were trying to port to the Macintosh. This was in 2000, 2001. And man, was that a weird system when it first came out. It still is, but it was really weird then. And we managed to abstract a lot of the complexity of dealing with portability issues into these wrapper scripts and into the BuildLink system. For instance, if you take some random package that expects the GNU compiler, expects the GNU linker, and you try to compile it on Solaris with Sun Pro or what have you, it might not build. But if you import it into package source, all of a sudden it has a chance because we're intercepting all those weird GCC-specific things that a package might do if it doesn't know any better, without even changing the package, just by including it in a system that uses these wrappers. So the infrastructure is one of the things about package source that really stands out. And even though Johnny apparently is finding usability issues with it, he did some amazing work with that. Package source is the official package system of NetBSD. That's where it came from. And Dragonfly adopted it. I don't know the entire story behind that, but they have a fellow named Jörg Sonnenberger who has been working his tail off, and it's almost better supported on Dragonfly than on NetBSD at this point. He's a workhorse. I don't know where he finds the time. And then for people who find that they're stuck with a gajillion different Unix systems where they have to manage all the kinds of software that you have to manage, package source is interesting because it lets you do the same thing on all the different systems. You don't have to do apt on one and think on another and this and that and the other. It's the same procedures that you can generalize across all of your platforms. So what is this conference? Package source con. Sounds kind of nerdy. It is kind of nerdy. It's an annual conference. At this point, we've had it four times for discussing package source. And for going to Europe and drinking beer. That's one of the reasons I go. But really, it's about package source. Really. So what happened in Barcelona this weekend? That's where package source con was. I don't know. I didn't see much Barcelona. We were in a conference room. But conference ran Friday through Sunday, as I said. We had a room set aside at the Technical University in Barcelona. We had one of our developers in Barcelona is a student there or somehow still affiliated with it, so we were able to get the space. We had 10 talks that were planned, and we didn't actually have them. Plus, there was more talking. Can't stop them. So what happened on Friday? The first talk was by Jörg, the Dragonfly developer, who gave us all the updates in the package source world. Basically, he combed through the CVS logs since last year. I don't have that kind of time. Again, I don't know where he gets it. And he showed us all the interesting things that we've done, and comparing and contrasting from last year to this year. And then we had Cube, who's from France. He has a pretty tough job, which is that he's administering something like 8 different platforms. I think most of them are variations of Linux. But his job is to provide different environments for the developers in the company where he works to test their application on various environments. And you can imagine that's a handful to try and build similar environments on different systems. And he does it with, I think it was with Xen, and with package source on these various systems. I couldn't listen very carefully, it was scary. So that was a short day. We all had to get in the afternoon and register, and we had just 2 talks. Saturday was a longer day, and I missed some of it, like I said. The first talk was what Jim just summarized for you. The second was David Maxwell, who I think was at the conference last year. And he talked about the advantages and possibilities of if you had package source able to build software from snapshots of like a CVS repository or Subversion in addition to actual release tarballs. He has a particular commercial application that he was talking about, but it's a general interest, so he gave us a talk. Then we have Christoph Madura, who's an old-timer in the BSD world. He says he doesn't have commit access. He does. He just doesn't use it. But he gave us what he thinks about package source from the point of view of somebody who doesn't know all the secrets that some of us real hardcore package source developers do, and how he, you know, the documentation shortcomings that he runs into, behavioral issues with the way that package source works, whatever he ran into that developers sometimes lose sight of because they're so used to it. He's in a position where he's able to tell us what we're missing. That was one of my favorite talks. We had a panel with Jorg from Dragonfly and me talking about macOS 10, and Roland Illig talking about IRIX, if you can imagine, using package source on that platform, and also Solaris, and then Cube talking about Linux again. And then Sunday, the last day of the conference, one of our release engineers and also the host of Backers Source Con 2 years ago talked about what it's like to do the dirty work. All you ever see is a CVS commit with the little square brackets, and he talked about the procedures that they use and how they arrived at them and what works and what doesn't work and why we should give them more credit, things like that. Then I gave my talk of dubious general interest, which if you want I can give you a short version of it. But basically I talked about Dan Bernstein's software and how the packages in package source are actually in pretty good shape, and we're almost at the point where we could dare to distribute binary packages and, you know, be in line with his requirements for doing that, which is kind of scary if you think about it. We're not quite there, but we're close, and so I get to talk about that. And then Jorg talked about a plan that he has for this infrastructure stuff that I just talked about, for simplifying and improving that. And then the last official talk was by Roland Illig, talking about how we have the capacity to do builds and installs without even being root. And there are certain things that don't work, obviously, like setuid programs, but on the whole, he was able to build something like 4,000 packages, which is pretty impressive. And that's just the way things are now. I didn't even know that was being worked on. I got to pay attention. Also informally, Johnny talked just after that about a research-flavored project that he's been working on experimentally at his employer. The details were pretty thin, but it's an idea he had separately from Package Jam. If it goes further, obviously, we'll hear more about it. And this was key for me. It's really difficult when you have two people in New York and one in London and one in Vienna to find a time, especially if one of them has random class schedule like I do, to find a time where they can all talk. And Al couldn't make it, unfortunately, but Johnny and Thomas Klausner and I were all there. And in about half an hour, we found some direction for the project that we had been... We've been fishing to try and set some high-level goals for package source for a long time. And within half an hour of actually face-to-face talking to each other, we had something. So we need to run it by Al still, but we were all very happy with that. In addition to the official stuff, every day after all the talks, we all went out to a gigantic dinner. And when I say gigantic dinner, I mean it's part of the custom in Spain, I guess. We were in Barcelona. You eat at about 9 p.m. at the earliest, and you eat about 3 courses at the least. It's deranged. And of course, there's a lot of beer, and they have a champagne-like local delicacy called cava, bottle right over there. And we just get a little drunk, and we have a gigantic table with developers sitting all around it, and it was a lot of fun, but it also resulted in discussions just happening, because you had a lot of people sitting next to each other with different opinions about things, just completely organically. And to my mind, even more than the formal talks, that may have been the best thing that happened at the conference, is just having all these people near each other in close proximity, talking about whatever comes to mind with whoever's sitting next to me. For example, me. From that DJBware talk, and from before the talk, and from after the talk, people who don't run that software, don't particularly like that software, don't really have an interest one way or the other, they still had ideas for ways that we could be in line with the redistribution requirements, technical ideas. I didn't really think I was going to get any feedback other than you're crazy, but I got actual specific ideas from people, which was pretty cool. And this one wasn't so much of a surprise, but still, so So I was having a conversation with one developer after an official talk. He has a Mac, I have a Mac, and getting package source bootstrapped on a Mac, you have to know what you're doing and you have to know that it's worthwhile because it's a little bit too much work to get it started. And we had some ideas of how to make it a simpler process to get going. And we both realized there are probably other people here who care about this. And there were a handful. And there were a handful who couldn't make it to the conference that have worked on package source on the Mac or are developers that have had an interest in it. And I just said, you know what, let's make a mailing list. And we have a dozen NetBSD and package source developers already as of a few days ago. And that's the kind of thing that you don't even realize you need it until you start having those conversations. And that's just me. I don't know what other people were talking about. I couldn't possibly know about all of them. So that's what happened at the conference, and I have a few reflections and thoughts about it. The first one is about productivity. As I said, this was our fourth package source con, so we're really getting good at it. The organizers did a great job. There were no hiccups to speak of. For the first time this year, we had a digital video camera, and pending individual speakers allowing the talks to become public, we'll have that available soon. Like I said earlier, it's when you don't normally get a lot of time with people in person, which is what things are like on an international online project like package source, it's easy to forget how useful that can be. And then conversely, when it actually happens, it's amazing how much you can get done in a short amount of time. My second set of thoughts about the conference in retrospect has to do with openness. And this wasn't really this wasn't intentional, it wasn't a mistake. It was really horrible. We didn't have a lot of attendees that weren't developers, so we mostly knew each other already. And we didn't do anything even semi-formal, like going around and introducing ourselves, because I know you, I know you, I know you, you know me, you know me. We've been doing this for a few years, we've been working together for a while, and there were a few people who were new to the whole thing that, in retrospect, they probably didn't feel very included. And I would like to see us improve that. Something as simple as going around and saying, I'm Amitai Schleyer, I use package source on NetBSD and Macintosh. I'm annoyed by how difficult it is to update all your packages. Hi. And if everybody did that, then those of us who know each other, we might even learn something. Like, I don't know what applications exactly Johnny is using, and he's my mentor, and we play Ultimate Frisbee together, and I've known him for a few years, and I don't know exactly what he's doing with package source. What about the people I don't know, you know? And we should basically treat anybody who's willing to go to the trouble of attending package source con as somebody who might eventually become a developer for us. And we didn't, you know, set out the red carpet for people. Even though there were only a few, we still didn't make the effort we should have. So next time we'll do better.
I walked out just for a quick second, but one of my questions about that is like, okay, you know you're gonna have loads of developers, but I don't know the extent to which people use it in production. I mean, I hear like rumors about people songs using it. I hear this, I hear that, but overall, you know, Dragonfly is still, you know, hasn't exactly, you know, it's there, it's going, brilliant stuff happening, there's no question about it, but it hasn't quite broken through. It's not like there's some face of like Vario Yahoo, you know, or like the perimeter of Adobe or something like that. So that's, I mean, to me, that's the ultimate problem. The question of developers and users, or, you know, sysadmins. Can use this, right? I mean, if you don't really want people going to vote, right? You know, I have problems with package source at home or my Windows box because it's conflicting with, my metal bar or the metal pepper or old games. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, unless
we'd like to have that problem.
Production situations, do you really want to hear what an end user is doing for? You know?
Yes and no. I mean, two of the most interesting talks at this conference, they were people who were NetBSD developers, but not really package source developers. Three, actually, three talks. One of which was just point of view of a user, and two of which were applications, actual business applications, a package server. And I'm always interested to hear about that.
Oh, no, that's, I mean, because that's really where things break through, right? Greatest theory, greatest theory of life. You know, what developers are doing is great, but I mean, I think sort of from a sysadmin perspective, it's like, cool, something can be really good, really well thought out, but there's a number of hurdles actually using something in production. Mm-hmm. And one is, frankly, other people using production.
Right.
You know? And unless people actually see a critical mass hit, you know, tipping point type of thing, mm-hmm. where you feel like, well, that's cool. You know, so-and-so is very, some guy blog on IBM who's doing, you know.
There's a particular so-and-so that I would like to say, but that I'm not at liberty to. Soon, though, hopefully. It should be public knowledge soon.
But it just seems to me that that ultimately is the problem with seeing a developer in office. No, no, just in large production scenario. That's, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. Doesn't make sense.
You know, I obviously am biased. I like package stores. I think it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. But it was an eye-opener for me when Q, giving his talk, toward the end, he said, basically, package stores is way better at solving this problem than anything else. And it wasn't from bias. I mean, he complained about how it sucks on Linux in some ways. But he said, there's really nothing else that I could even try to approach solving this problem.
What's the problem?
He had something like 8 or 9 different Linux systems, and I think some Solaris that he had to. He's responsible for making them similar systems so that he can test the software the developers are working on. So it's basically sysadmin for 9 different extremely heterogeneous environments, and keeping that up to date and deploying the software because developers don't know how to deploy software. So. That was really an eye-opener for me, and I assumed that package stores is always right, and I didn't even think of that. So, your question is complex, and the answer is complex, but we did get corporate input at this package stores con, and it was pretty exciting.
Follow-up to your last statement.
Yeah.
I read a while ago that Sun was throwing some money at package stores. Is that still the case?
I don't know much about it. I don't think it is still the case. I think the people who were doing the work are no longer with Sun. This is hearsay, so I don't know for sure. But I don't think they're doing it now. Which is too bad, because that was exciting when it was happening. So the last of my set of reflections on this conference has to do with the people who are there. And this is my third of the four. I missed last year's in Paris, sadly. And it's always been a good group of people, but for some reason we gelled instantaneously this year. It may be that we already know each other. It may be that we've all been to Package Stores Con before. We know what to expect. We know what we're about to get into. Could be the double strength beer they have in Barcelona. I don't know what it is, but right from the get go, socially and technically, we were hitting it off. Like I said earlier, between talks, in the middle of talks, raising hands, asking questions, here, there, outside the conference room, during dinner, drinking excessively for some people, just a lot of conversation, and a lot of it had to do with problems we were trying to solve. And yeah, mailing lists are great, and yeah, chatting online is great. You can get a lot done that way, but there's something about putting all the people in a room that should pay off, and here it really did. So one of the reasons why I think this worked is that we all know each other, we've worked together for years. Like I said earlier, there is this project management committee that's supposed to arbitrate, but we almost never have to. People understand how to deal with other people. We have people with tempers. We have people who aren't always reasonable. And everybody has learned how to get what they need from other people and how to behave. It's really kind of amazing in a project like this that has happened. But the upshot of that is that with this shared history, it's easy to walk up to somebody and know they're not going to shoot you down just to shoot you down. They're going to measure your idea on its merits. They're going to hear your reasoning based on whether it makes sense or not. And you're also expecting that they're going to be critical in a constructive way. And so there's a synergy there. You want to have a conversation with somebody because you know they're going to make it a better idea when you expose it to them. And I just want to say that I'm touched. This is really nice for me. I mean, I've been doing package stores for a while, and I know a lot of the people individually. And it really hit home when I was looking back at how the weekend went that I'm really lucky to be part of a project like this. I've done software development at companies, in volunteer projects, you know, in a consulting capacity, where you can't stand the people that you're working with, and it makes you almost not want to do the work, especially in a volunteer project. In a volunteer project, this is all you have, is that it's fun. And we have that, and I'm thrilled about it. I can't say enough about it. So, that's enough talking from me. What do you need to do now that you've read this talk? First up, we'll have the videos pretty soon. As soon as Julio figures out the right encoding and we get approval from the speakers to have their talks be public. The slides should be online probably within the next few days. You must continue. This one doesn't work if you're not already using package stores. You should start to use Enlove package stores. I promise you it pays off. You should get involved if you have time and interest. We have lots to do, so help is always welcome. And we're not jerks, like I was just saying, so you might enjoy it. Whether or not you're a developer or a user or somebody who's heard of package stores, if you like beer and Europe and nice people, you should come to Package Source Con next year. We haven't decided where. It could be London, it could be Hamburg, it could be Berlin. Those are the ideas that are floating around right now. It totally depends on who's willing to do the organizing. But it'll probably be one of those places. And they're all nice places, so I hear. The end. That's the summary of the weekend. Any questions, thoughts? Yes, please. Anybody have any words at all about anything? Are you all asleep?
How many developers were there?
We had about 24. Yeah. All right, I think our biggest dinner bill was around 500. I think we got 580 euro one day.
Like
$2,000. Really? I don't even know what I'm paying for dinner. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So, if people have any interest in my rehashing this DJ Beware talk, the slides will be online in a few days. Does anybody have any interest in particular? You'd like to hear about it? So I'll go over it really quickly, if that's alright. Okay. Yes. La la la. Looks awfully similar. So I'll run through this really quickly. I was expecting, kind of like in this room, not very many people would be interested. And I said, this is probably not the reason that you'd be interested in this talk. This was more likely. Yeah. So I won't talk about this too much. So first, I want to define my terms. You like that one? You like that one? People familiar with the term rubbernecking? Okay. I was worried about it in Europe, but they seem to get it. Yeah. So what is DJ Beware? You could say that it's software written by Dan Bernstein, and that's it. And obviously, for any of you who've seen it before, you know what it looks like and what it smells like. There are issues with redistributing it because he doesn't put a license on the software because of his interpretation of U.S. software law. Very interesting. But he also adds, on top of that, some restrictions about what you can distribute. For instance, Qmail, you can't change it and call it the same thing. That's what he's concerned about. And there are third-party packages that exist sometimes. And I'm sad to say this one points to the FreeBSD port of Qmail, because it's kind of gross. Other FreeBSD ports of BGBware are pretty good. The Qmail one is not great. And then obviously, those of you who have followed this political upheaval, know that years ago in the OpenBSD ports tree, all the DJBeware was just removed. And interestingly, Bernstein tried to fight against that. For all the people who think that he just doesn't want his software packaged, he was arguing with Theo, if you can imagine the Armageddon, leave it in, read the distribution terms, they're not complicated, you can comply with them. And Theo said, no, it's not free, forget about it. And I can understand both things.
They wanted to actually have it so that it wouldn't just go directly to boot, right? So the license said that when you install the software, you can't modify the location where it gets installed.
Right.
I don't think that was the issue in saying it's not free. The issue is saying that based on the terms that you want us to distribute this, we don't want to distribute like that, so we're honoring your entity's law of job.
Okay. So OpenBSD had been changing the paths, or?
Well, basically what happened, so like,
I don't remember the whole story.
I'm not familiar. So on the previous day, right, the port gets to go to your local, right? So it's probably similar to OpenBSD, but the problem with that is that the license that is not really a license, but the terms at which he will allow you to use his software states that, you know, when you actually go to install it, you can't modify the path of where you install. So don't modify the main file or whatever, so that you install the procedural local thing. I want to install them in the group, right? It's kind of a big thing. People don't really kind of like that.
Good.
So the thread wasn't about, like, oh, we don't... The thread was that Theo dropped it because they said, well, DGD doesn't want us to do this, and like, we don't want it to install the way it does, so we're good.
It's kind of an impasse.
With that, and then... It's sort of got off topic for using these sort of recusing but
you're a jerk. No, you're a jerk. No, you're a jerk.
Right.
They're both right.
So the thing that was interesting too is that then like, you know, DGD started to accuse the old including non-free software because there's wrappers in there for Netscape to like that, but I think the original problem was that you're not allowed to just, you know, change it. So
I gave a talk 2 years ago at PackageSourceCon about what I did for the Keymail package in PackageSource to get around that. Previously, it had been installing into var Keymail as expected, but the package tools were confused because they couldn't register the files. They weren't under user package or user local or anything like that. And there were a number of other issues. So what I did is I wrote basically a shell script that runs before the Keymail installer. And it creates var Qmail, and it creates symlinks in each of the subdirectories that the Qmail installer would create, and then it has them point into the BSD style hierarchy. Then when the Qmail installer runs, it just follows the symlinks. And so you still have these paths that start with var Qmail that end up in the right place. You can call it that, and you get the binary, you get the man page. But the actual files are following the BSD style hierarchy. And so that way, the package tools can register it, you can deinstall it easily. It does have the names the DJB wants it to have, but also it's in your path by default. You have to change man path to get the man pages, all that kind of stuff. That was complicated. It took a while to figure out how to do that. Anyway, so the upshot is packaging this stuff is hard because he makes it hard. And I'm sure he realizes that, but it's still true. As to why?
As to why he's going class of all and wants to
do it. My best reading of his intent is that he works pretty hard at making his software bit perfect according to his mental specification. And he's deathly afraid of somebody downloading something that looks like it's from him and is called the same thing as something from him. And doesn't behave exactly the same as something from him.
What about chat songs?
Right, he has that. He says the way it works is if you want to distribute the source, it has to match the checksum, and if you want to distribute a binary package, it has to behave the same way as what a user would get by following all the defaults. So this is why there's the whole ecosystem of patches in the DJD world. Speaking of ecosystem, so on top of the software written by Dan Bernstein, there's software written by other people under the influence, as I say, of Dan Bernstein that kind of fits into the ideas that he has promulgated. Either the detail of what the code looks like, or how things fit together, or both. And most other people, since they're not DJB, do put licenses on their software. Usually it's a GNU license, but not always. And there is some software that actually uses his code, which some of it is questionable from a distribution standpoint, and then some of his code is public domain, which has the usual ramifications of that. If you want to call this secondary DJBware, cool, I'm gonna. And this is the upshot of that. So, if we're talking about DJBware and package source, how much is there? This is the primary stuff, and there's a whole lot of secondary stuff. That's a deliberate style choice there. So it's not so much an ecosystem, it's more of a zoo if we don't keep it under control. And this is not all the DJBware in the world, far from it. This is just what we have in package source. So as the guy that seems to spend the most time of anybody of package source developers working on this, it was in my interest to try and make this easier and more reliable, a packaging process. So I'm glad you asked if there's some common code, because yes, there is. As of 2 years ago, I presented, as part of the same talk about the QMail package, a new file as part of the infrastructure that is, it handles a few common tasks for a lot of DJBware. One is that by default, unless the package says otherwise, it's restricted, which means in practice that it can't be uploaded to, as binary packages can't be uploaded to an FTP server, and the source, I think the source is okay in FTP, all the usual ramifications. I thought about it once, and I put the thinking into this one file, and then all the DJBware benefits from it. His makefile targets are not the same as the default package source ones, so I handled that once here. And he doesn't use anything remotely resembling GNU configure. He just has these little one-line files that say, what's the path to my compiler, what's the path to my headers that I need to include, where do I want this installed. So that's all handled in a default situation as of 2 years ago in djbware.nk. And then there's this programming error, believe it or not, by the great God, which is, once upon a time, I guess it was okay to just explicitly declare this variable as an int, but glibc, newer than some version, has it defined differently. And so the fix, obviously, is to include the file where it's defined, rather than just defining it. Amazing how that works. And that fixes it. So we have a little set expression that goes through and fixes that. Yeah. I don't know, but it's something to do with threading, that it isn't just an int anymore. Is it? I've never seen it. Okay. So obviously on a system where it compiled before, this is a no-op, and then on a system with the glibc, it's a correctness issue. And the makefiles for various DJBware programs and package source used to have a do configure target or a post-patch target or so on and so forth. They were essentially doing the same things. They might not necessarily quote everything the same way. They might not follow all the same steps. By centralizing this, they all behave the same way configure does. Those 2 years ago, we got a little more now. That set expression is now a package option, which is something that Jim just talked about. And so you can define it to be on or off globally, on a per package basis, all the things that you can do with package options and package source. We have a fellow who has been doing license sweeps, and about a year ago he suggested that we basically express that there is no license, and the way that you can do that in package source is with a license variable. Strangely enough. So we put a little file called the DJB non-license, which has a link to his webpage that explains terms for redistributors and his thoughts on US software law, and it's all very fascinating to somebody who wants to read it. But the point is, you have to agree that it's okay with you before you can install the software. So this is, you'd have to add DJB non-license to acceptable licenses in mk.conf before it would build. I thought that was a very good thing to do.
Is he okay with all these things and your interpretations of his license?
Is Bernstein?
Yeah.
I'll come to that, actually. But generally, I've tried to do what I think he would say to do if he ever responded to email. We've added a bit more, for instance, there's a fellow named Bruce Gunter that writes a bunch of software that fits in well with Qmail and so on. And he also uses conf-something-something. And so we handle some of those also centrally. There's enough of that software that it matters. And then a couple other developers who probably wish their names weren't on this page helped with making the glibcfix supply more files that needed it and quoting issues. Yeah, let's not talk about that. That's weird. Even weirder, I mean. So the situation today is that we have very few patches that we're applying by default. And obviously, if you want to redistribute things, the goal is zero. It doesn't hurt to have them available as options, but what we want to happen is do a bulk build, and you get what you would get compiling by default, which is exactly what DJB wants redistributors of binary packages to do. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting closer. Likewise with the paths. And there's a solution to this that the Qmail does that I explained just a minute ago that is generalizable and we should reuse it, which is one of the files is called conf bin or conf path, depending on the package, that usually says user local bin or something of that ilk. And we should not change it by default. We should leave it the way it is and then create symlinks that map things into the default path. And then if you know what you're doing, you can define a variable in mk.conf that says, I'm not an idiot, I don't want this crap, I'm not going to distribute this package, just change the path. But we have a solution by default that should work for this. Just need to implement it. The package options were implemented just before my talk 2 years ago. And especially for something like Qmail, where modern functionality is implemented by third parties, and by patches in particular, this package options framework was a godsend because I define something like 7 or 8 options in my build. I get all the NetQmail packages or patches. I get a DNS-related patch, a whole bunch of stuff. Obviously, if the patches conflict, we're not going to automatically solve that for you, but it so happens that everything I want doesn't conflict. And all I have to do is define package options, Qmail equals these 8 things, and it happens for me. York suggested that we had a variable called no package that had been set on Qmail for a long time, and we've been getting rid of that in general throughout package source because it doesn't really have any meaning. It just means that we shouldn't try and build a binary package. It doesn't say why not. And so we do build it, we just don't redistribute it. And what that allows us to happen is the couple dozen packages, believe it or not, that depend on Qmail can be tested in a bulk build. So that was an easy change and very worthwhile. Let me indulge myself for a second here. One of the really weird things about Qmail and all the other DJBware is he wants you to use daemon tools and slash service, and he wants all your daemons to run in the foreground. He wants them to log a standard error. He expects that you're going to use a program such as his that will handle all these children running in the foreground and catch their standard error. It's a very interesting system, but NetBSD and some of these other BSD systems have rc.d, which I think is a really nice subsystem, and I handle all my other daemons that way. And I would really like to handle all of my daemons that way. So I wrote some shell scripts that are part of a separate package for Qmail called Qmail Run, and for DJBDNS called DJBDNS Run, that you install those and you have rc.d scripts and you can turn, with a yes or a no, you can turn off Qmail send, Qmail smtpd, Qmail pop3d. There's a little Qmail queue read service so that you can type mail queue even if you're not root, if you want to have that turned on. And likewise for DJBDNS. If you want to learn about how to write some crazy ass shell scripts, take a look at these. And after a lot of discussion with a lot of people, we know where we stand. We know what we would have to do legally to be able to redistribute this stuff. Quick comparison, Right. The best packages of EJB were available that I have seen are Debian's, but they have their own license issues. It's never going to be included in the system. It's a third-party thing. You have to add it to your package source list. One of them is a source package. One of them is a binary package. They're both really well done. I learned a lot from looking at them. But it's precisely Debian's license crusade that I think is an opening for package source, because we are really not far from being able to include these binary packages.
Which ones are previously good?
I haven't looked carefully. I believe like Uxpy TCP, which is the TCP client, TCP server. I think that one's pretty okay. The issue with the QML one in particular is it's a god-awful gigantic make file with tons of conditionals. It's pretty hard to read. There are lots of other QML packages that are variations of it that reach into it in some godforsaken state-keeping kind of a way that unless you wrote it, you don't know what it's doing. And I didn't write it, so I don't know what it's doing. So I'm allowed to hate it from where I stand. It might even work well, I don't know, but it doesn't look like it should. Yeah.
Anybody using like daemon tools? I mean, anybody
uses
this?
Yeah, it's a great system.
I tried it out literally, I mean, I'm actually like 7 years ago, 6 years ago, and that was it. Because when I was coming around the BSD stuff, you see people like, why do you need it?
And if you look, I think it's a great design. And for a long time, there were people's web pages with proud discoveries of how to make something run in the foreground and log the standard error. And you could Google around and find how to get everything to run that way. I know people who do. And it's fascinating. If I were stuck with an IRIX machine, for instance, where I don't really care for its boot sequence, I might switch everything over to Daemon Tools. But I primarily am using NetBSD, and I love RC.D. So, and ironically, VJD software doesn't often need to be forcibly restarted.
So along those same lines, have you tried run it?
No, I've read about it, but I have not tried it. Do you prefer that one?
No.
Okay. Yeah, it exists. Yeah. I think there's a package for it in package source with, for what it's worth. So what we have left to do, if we wanted to distribute binary packages, which I do, I don't know if that's clear, I do, we have a bug in our bulk build upload script, although it may be gone at this point, actually. I didn't check recently. Sometimes they find their way up to the server. We have to make sure that doesn't happen. Obviously, since DJB is not the only software out there in the world, other people occasionally do come up with updates for QML and the ilk. And when that happens, we need to add package options for these good new patches. This is the main technical issue with the QML package right now, is that because DJB doesn't trust a runtime lookup of a user ID or a group ID, these numbers are compiled into the binaries. Again, interesting design choice. What's even more interesting is for the packager, he has instructions. There's a tool included with the QML distribution called IDEdit. And the instructions basically say, find the byte offsets in the binaries of this ID and that ID and that ID using NM and system-specific knowledge. May not be impossible to generalize that for all the platforms the package source runs on, but it probably is difficult. Anyway, it's certainly unusual. And the challenge there is that, of course, like any package system worth its salt, we have checksums of these binaries. And if we edit them, the checksums are not going to be right. So that's something that I have to figure out how to work around. At the very least, I want to allow the checksums to change the once, and then once they're installed, not expecting to change again. But right now, with our package tools, that's hard. But that's really the key technical issue between us and a redistributable QML, believe it or not. The slash package thing, probably worth spending a little bit of time on it. And then the patch thing I talked about, leave it alone and create symlinks. Go patch. And this one, technically, we have what we need to be able to do it. make sure that if anything was changed from the default state of the package, including if a user has local patches set, if anything was done to the default build, set restricted, so that it's you have to really intentionally override when you distribute a package that has these modifications. And that we have what we need in package source to make that happen. Whoops, a little too big here. But we know that one. Distribute binary packages. What are you on? So these are the requirements, which we talked about a little bit. You have to make sure that it's exactly the same stuff a user would get if they did it themselves and didn't change anything. This behaving correctly thing, kind of hard to guarantee, but he does get you off the hook for any bug that is by saying the same way as other systems would. And then this last sentence is the kicker. The package's creator has to say that they made a good faith attempt that the package behaves correctly. Now, I don't think this is a very strong statement. I'm willing to make it. I'm not saying that I warrant that the package does behave correctly. I'm saying I warrant that I've made a good faith attempt. That's pretty plain English. I'm not a lawyer, but it's pretty plain English. We took this up with the leadership of the NetBSD Foundation, and they didn't really like the idea of saying anything like this. And there was some discussion with board and with the fellow who was doing the license sweep through package source. And basically the conclusion was, I would be willing to say that if I was the only one that would be liable. But if the NetBSD Foundation could possibly be liable for this, with the guy who's as potentially a wild card as DJB, I don't think he would want to sue us for making a serious effort to distribute good packages of the software, considering how few people do it, but you can never be sure. Exactly. Yeah. Who knows? So I completely understand why the NetBSD Foundation said, don't say that, but it makes me sad. It turns out there may be a workaround from having the conversation with people at PackageSourceCon. If you look at the wording, the package's creator has to make the warrant and not the distributor. The distributor would be an FDSD Foundation because the binary would be on fdp.netbsd.org. But arguably I'm the creator and I'm willing to say that and it doesn't affect who's distributing it. So again, this is legalese, which is a little scary, but maybe it could be interpreted generously that way. So, almost done. Right, the thing I mentioned on the first slide about no matter what your opinion is about this, you can feel superior. If you don't use DJBware at all, you can say, that guy is ridiculous. Why is he spending so much time fighting with this stuff? And you'd be right.
I'm only to be the next DJB versus game.
If you do use DJBware and package source, then you can look down on people who are installing it manually or through some other method, because we're better, nanner. That may not be true. I think it is. And either way, if you're a package source user, you can be proud that we've at least gone to the trouble, because it's a pretty good situation that we have right now. A recent thing that supports my theory here. There was a discussion on the QMail mailing list a couple months ago that on top of NetQMail, you don't really have much. You don't have SMTP auth, you don't have TLS. You still got to go find patches for that, or LDAP or what have you. And so there was the idea that we should get the best patch for each of these really key features that a lot of people need these days, which is what NetQMail was when it was first released, but we need more now. And the conversation didn't really go very far. I was interested to participate in it, but I didn't want to do very much work. And the reason why is that package source already had this with the package option. I say package options QMail equals TLS, SASL, whatever it is that I need, and I have it. So I pointed them at the package, and I never heard more. But I don't need to work on that. I have it for what I need. So we're nearing the end, thank goodness. If you use package source, this is the neat thing. You can install DJBware with some impunity because it's really easy to uninstall. That's what package systems are good for. So take 10 minutes, try installing QMail and QMail run, see what you think. I even use the rc.d scripts on Mac OS X, they work there too. It's so easy to install a full functional QMail, for instance, from package source, that I do it on every machine even if it doesn't have an important mail function. It's just that easy. Somebody say something?
So you just put MPAs on boxes for a second?
Well, they usually have to send out nightly reports, so I'd rather have it be a mailer that I can debug. I'd rather use a mailer that I can debug. Exactly. DJVware is yet another area where package source is strong. And there's always more to be done, so please help out, which doesn't apply to you, but this for some of the people in the room. And yeah. So that was my DJVware talk. Thank you for sitting through that. I appreciate it. I'm all out of words, so thanks for listening.